This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Ubiome. Your gut is home to trillions of microbes, about as many as the amount of human cells in your body. Those microbes may affect your health in countless ways. They might help you digest food, manufacture vitamins, improve your mood, or even fight off illness. So you've got a whole world to explore, but is your gut keeping up? You can find out with SmartGut by Ubiome. SmartGut is a quick and easy at-home test that helps you understand if your gut bacteria are working with you or against you by screening for microbes associated with IBS, IBD, and many other chronic conditions. Sampling is quick and easy. It takes less than 3 minutes. It's also healthcare provider ordered and reimbursed by most health insurance. Request your SmartGut test today. Just go to ubiome.com/explorers. That's ubiome.com/explorers. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast.
This episode of She Explores is brought to you by OtterBox. You might be most familiar with their phone cases, for Android and iPhones alike. But did you know they have a whole outdoor line to help fuel both your everyday and extraordinary adventures? OtterBox's durable hard and soft coolers and tumblers help keep your food and drinks cold. I recently took my Venture 45 cooler out to the beaches of Whidbey Island in the Pacific Northwest to enjoy some time by the water. With OtterBox, no matter where your adventures take you, to the river or a campsite or your local park, you'll know you have the essentials covered. Because your outdoor experiences don't have to be complicated or intimidating or epic, but with the right gear and an open mind, they're usually fun. Learn more about OtterBox and unrule the outdoors by heading to otterbox.com.
I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores. Today, we have a treat at the start of the episode. Siobhan Powell is here to tell us about a very special outdoor festival that she's planning just 30 miles from Seattle, Washington. It's taking place the last weekend of September, and it's called the Refuge Outdoor Festival. Siobhan was in a crowded place when we talked, so there's a bit of background noise, but her energy shines through.
The Refuge Outdoor Festival is a 3-day camping experience. It is geared toward people of color, inclusive of everyone, to build community through outdoor recreation, community conversations, art, and music. My goal is to shift the narrative around who belongs in the outdoors via this event. It's not a one-off event because it's really about building community. Representation is important. And what is the prolonged engagement? So it's about bringing in community organizations, people doing the good work on diversity and inclusion in the outdoors, and, you know, getting more eyes and more attention on that. So I'm always in everything that I do. I also say that it's not about the one weekend. It's about getting more people connected in the outdoors and for a lifelong love of the outdoors.
Oh, so you hope people stay connected after the event?
Absolutely. Be connected with each other in a deeper way. We all know that you may not see someone for 15 years, but you remembered that hike you went on with them. So it's about connecting people in a deeper way and connecting to resources. There are some awesome groups out there doing some amazing work. So we're bringing in partners like Girl Trek and Outdoor Asian, Latino Outdoors, Climbers of Color, all of these organizations to connect people to know that there are opportunities for you to connect when you're back at home and get out and explore with other people that look like you or that you want to be around a diverse body of people. So that was really important for me to be able to bring in those pieces and have sponsors support those organizations to come.
Oh, that's so great. And when you first described it, you said that it's for people of color, inclusive of everyone. I know on the website it says that the festival is for people of color and allies. Why was it important for you to include both?
One, I think that my first and foremost is I wanted to make this space as comfortable for people of color to come outside because not all of our opportunities to get outside are created equal. Mm. And I'll say that from my experience. I had a police incident where I was pulled over when I was going on my first solo backpacking trip. And the police officer told me that it was unbelievable that I was going outside to do outdoor recreation and call back up. So that's why I leaned in with people of color first, because I looked out and I didn't really see those opportunities or that verbiage of saying, hey, I'm creating this space for you, with you in mind, you front and center, elevating your voice and your, you know, your face to say that, hey, we are here or we want to be here. And there's nothing unbelievable about that. But I also think that as we move forward as a society, we have to do things together. So I think that it's important for everybody to come together. And it's not only important for people of color to see people of color doing outdoor recreation and environmental justice. It's important for everyone to see that. So everyone needs to be in the space.
Can you tell me a little bit about what people can expect who attend? Like what the atmosphere will be like, what activities might be going on at the event?
Yeah, I'm super excited about that. So like I said, we're bringing in a lot of community partners and sponsors. And my request for a lot of folks is to host or lead an activity or conversation. So we have Girl Trek leading hikes. We have Seattle Audubon doing bird watching walks. We also have conversations around race and privilege. We have the healing properties of nature as an evening session. We have access to trails, multi-use trails, which are bikes and hiking trails. There's access to water. There's a tent, which is called the Synchronicity House, because refuge is important. This is creating a safe space so people can decompress from everything that life is. There's this space where people can go and just have someone prepare tea for them and just go and relax. And then in the evenings, there are concerts and a silent disco. So it's a full-on experience, and it's how do we get outside, disconnect to reconnect. So it's really important to have a multitude of opportunities for people to do as much or as little as they want to.
Where can we find out more if we're interested in buying a ticket?
You can head over to the Refuge Outdoor Festival website, so refugeoutdoorfestival.com. Hit us up on Facebook or Instagram under Refuge Outdoor Festival as well. Tickets are up and live, and it's going to be an amazing, amazing weekend. We have some awesome performers and just awesome people coming to share.
Oh, I wish I could go. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Siobhan is a professional event planner, but she needs your help spreading the word. So head to refugeoutdoorfestival.com to learn more, buy a ticket if you live in the area, and share with a friend who you think might be interested. This is just the beginning for Refuge Outdoor Festival. Now, on to our interview.
It's such a great tool for studying the landscape or even remembering like what a plant looks like. And you don't have to create an amazing drawing. You can just spend some time drawing something out, even just making a diagram, and it'll help you remember what you saw. Maybe even ask some questions or look a little bit deeper at the thing that you're studying.
This is Kristen Link, and she's a science illustrator with an environmental focus. In the simplest sense, she helps people interpret landscapes. She helps us look up close at the natural world. I wanted to talk with Kristen so I could learn more about her profession as a science illustrator and how it overlaps with her work as an artist, both living off-grid in Alaska and as an artist in residence at various national parks. And whether or not you're a visual artist, odds are good that you hold some curiosity about the landscape that surrounds you, its history, and the flora and fauna found within it.
I live right outside a town called McCarthy, which is near the Canadian border, surrounded by the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve. Basically, the main hub of Alaska, at least like the main part of Alaska, not southeast, is Anchorage. So to get here, you'd usually drive 8 hours from Anchorage. You'd go to a town called Glen Allen, then head south, and then to a town called Chitna, which is where the pavement ends, and then drive a 60-mile dirt road out to McCarthy. So it's like as remote as you can be, or one of the most remote places you can be, but still be on the road system, so I can still get in my car and go elsewhere.
If you look up McCarthy, Alaska online, you'll see that there were 28 full-time residents in the 2010 census. I thought I grew up in a small town, but there were more kids than that in my fifth grade class. Kristen lives off the grid there with her partner Greg and her dog Jack. Living off the grid means she has a pretty intimate relationship with the land around her, which ties into her work as a science illustrator.
Living here, it's a little bit of a simpler lifestyle in some ways, but it's also, you know, you spend more time doing your chores, like hauling water or chopping firewood or working in the garden. And I think because you're providing those things for yourself, it's, you know, maybe a more economical lifestyle, or it gives you a lot of flexibility. It gives me a lot of flexibility to be able to be home or to travel and to make work.
Living that close to the landscape helps Kristen relax and breeds new ideas. But she didn't always live in Alaska. In fact, her love of this place came a bit by accident.
The first time I came up here was when I was in high school, actually. I went to high school in London, in England, and I had applied to the Student Conservation Association, does work crews during the summer. So they take groups of high school students, and you spend like 2 months volunteering for land use agencies, the Park Service or the Forest Service or BLM. But I applied, and you pick a region. You can say like, oh, I want to go to the Southwest, or I want to go to the Northwest. And so I picked like the Northwest and the Southwest because they are parts of the United States I hadn't been to very much. Even though I was living in London, my family's American and I lived in the United States for a while as well. But they basically assigned me to work on a crew for the Bureau of Land Management in the White Mountains north of Fairbanks. It was kind of a crazy experience. It rained a lot and we were camping on permafrost.
Wow.
So it was like kind of cold and boggy, but also really amazing. Just, I hadn't really seen landscapes like that or that kind of space. And so I spent 2 months up there and really loved it. And I remember when we would go into town to like do our laundry every once in a while, we were just so fascinated by people who lived in Alaska. And some of us would ask people, would be like, so what do you do in the winter? Like, what is it like in the winter here? And a lot of people said the winter is their favorite season. It was just really good time to kind of catch up with friends and do personal projects. And that really stuck with me. I always wanted to come back and see what the winter was like in Alaska. So after I graduated from college, I went to school in Vermont. I had a summer job, and then after that I wasn't sure what I was going to do. So I convinced a friend of mine to drive up to Alaska with me and spend the winter. And so that's what we did.
Whoa. So was it everything that you thought it would be? Like, because you probably built it up a bit in your head.
Maybe a little bit. I think the main reason why I wanted to come and see what it was like is I always really loved winter. And it was sort of a mystery what it would be like, you know, living in a place that was darker and colder. Like I said, I went to school in Vermont and the winters there were getting warmer, so I felt like they weren't like as satisfyingly fully winter as I wanted. Like it would rain a lot in the middle of winter, which, I mean, it does that here too. It's always frustrating, but I was pretty open-minded. I didn't know what it would be like. And we ended up, we didn't really have a plan when we got up here, but we ended up working for a family who has sled dogs. And so we were dog handlers, and basically we got room and board in exchange for helping take care of and train the sled dogs. So it was just like a totally different experience. I mean, I'd never done that before. And just learning about that sport and it's a whole lifestyle was really interesting and different. And it was nice also just to be outside so much.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a different kind of, you know, work than studying in school too.
Yeah, I was really ready to kind of do something more physical for a while. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do next. So it was just that winter was actually really lonely in a lot of ways. We were living in this town called Willow, which is south of Cantwell and where Denali National Park is and north of Anchorage. I mean, it's close enough to Anchorage that people could commute there for work, but it's also, I think people live there because they're like just close enough to town and far enough away that they have their own space. So a lot of people there, at least struck me as being like very independent and wanted their solitude. So it was kind of a hard community to get to know people in. And, you know, we were new. We just spent the winter there, so we didn't know a lot of people. So there was a lot of just time thinking and figuring out what I wanted to do. And I don't know, that was really good for me right then.
It was in the solitude of that winter that Kristen decided to go to graduate school for science illustration. She studied environmental science and studio art as an undergrad, but hadn't known before that she'd be able to combine them for her profession.
Like, for me at that point, I didn't know that I wanted to be an artist, but the more that I thought about what career I wanted to pursue or what path I wanted to go into next, the more I realized, like, how much I really loved doing art and how much I didn't really want to leave it behind. And my whole life, I've been interested in science and art, and people have always said, oh, well, you should try and combine them and do science illustration. But to me, I always pictured, like, the picture of the inner ear in the doctor's office or something like that. I was like, I don't know, it doesn't really sound that interesting to me. Not that, you know, medical illustration isn't interesting and wonderful, but it just didn't speak to me, especially when I was younger. And that winter, I finally looked up science illustration and found the program that I ended up applying to at California State University, Monterey Bay. Yeah, I just saw the work that other people were doing and how varied it was, and that science illustration could be a lot of different things, you know, from designing dioramas for museums or, you know, illustrating natural history, and that kind of my interest in looking at, like, the whole ecosystem or natural history could work with science illustration.
So how would you describe your science illustration work?
A lot of the work that I've done for other people is kind of looking at that environmental studies perspective, so taking a bigger approach and sort of explaining how a landscape works and how people fit into the landscape. So I've done work for, like, the Park Service or the Forest Service, doing interpretive signs or coloring books, but kind of taking that, these are all the things that make up the landscape, you know, like, there's bears and then there's people who come and watch the bears and this is what they're eating. You know, some people would take, like, a more focused approach, maybe looking at one thing specifically, maybe like paleontology or plants or fungi, you know, some, it gets really specialized, but I've always been interested in kind of that broader, bigger picture.
Yeah, and that helps. Yeah, you're kind of taking it from the perspective of someone who might not know anything, so they get to enter into a space and have a better understanding of a space.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of it's kind of interpreting the landscape for people who, you know, and it totally depends. Like, I did a series of interpretive signs that are on the side of the road. And so you might have, you know, people who are driving up to Alaska, and obviously they're, like, immersed in the landscape to a certain extent because they're driving through it. It's not like they just got off a boat and they're going to get back on a boat, but, you know, they don't know what they're looking at. So how do you connect that one spot on the river that you're seeing to the entire watershed, which is what that project was about, and help them kind of see a bigger picture of how things are connected and what else is going on beyond just that one vista that they see.
And it sounds like you've always been interested in the outdoors and the environment, where, I mean, you volunteered to do conservation work and build trails when you were in high school. Like, when did that kind of start for you, that interest?
Yeah, I have always really loved spending time outside. I think it started when I was really little. Both of my sets of grandparents lived in kind of more rural places. My dad's parents lived in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, and my mom's parents lived outside Rangeley, Maine. And their place especially was, they lived out in this little pond, and when they built their cabin, they lived off the grid. When I was little and we'd go up there, they lived off the grid. They had a windmill and solar panels. And they were, like, right on the Appalachian Trail. Like, we used to walk. That was, like, the walk my grandfather used to do every day, was up to the Appalachian Trail. So my mom used to, like, taught us to go backpacking and hiking and spending time up there.
It was one of my favorite things when I was little, and it's something that I really craved just to kind of feel at peace with myself my whole life. So something that I think from doing that with my mom and my grandparents, and then when I got older, learning that I could do it a little bit more intentionally and doing summer programs like that one with the Student Conservation Association. When I was in college, I worked for the Green Mountain Club in Vermont on the Long Trail. As I got older, seeking seeking those opportunities out was really important to me.
I'll talk with Kristen about seeking opportunities in the form of artists and residency programs at national parks after this. This episode of She Explores is brought to you by RX Bar, a whole food protein bar that comes in 14 delicious flavor varieties, including chocolate sea salt, peanut butter chocolate, mixed berry, and maple sea salt. With RX Bar, what you see is what you get. The core ingredients are listed on the front of the package. Whole foods like almonds, dates, unsweetened chocolate, real fruit, and spices like cinnamon. And for protein, RX Bars use egg whites for a lean source that's easy for most bodies to absorb. My favorite flavor is peanut butter chocolate because I'm a sucker for all things peanut butter, and I like to eat it in the late afternoon so I have energy for a pre-dinner walk or workout. I've been eating them for years, so I'm really excited, and it feels a bit surreal to offer a 25% discount on your first order. 25%! That's, you know, if you buy four bars, that's one bar that's free. Just head to rxbar.com/sheexplores and enter the code SHEEXPLORES at checkout. And that code and on the URL, it's SHEEXPLORES with no space. Just so you don't miss it, it's rxbar.com/sheEXPLORES. They're delicious. This episode is also sponsored by Victorious. Victorious brings the fitness studio to you with live group fitness classes that you can participate in from anywhere at any time. It's also why I'm sore today, but in a good way. Victorious offers real-time fitness classes that you can stream live using your computer, phone, tablet, or television. It feels like you're at the gym, but you're at home. If you're like me, committing to a class can be a great motivator, but having to travel and show up at a fitness studio can be pretty challenging. Victorious makes it easy to stay committed because you can participate from anywhere. I've been a Victorious member for the past month, and I love the variety of the classes. I've done different high-impact interval training and yoga classes, and each one has been unique, even if they have the same name. And we've got a special offer exclusively for our listeners. Get one free month of unlimited Victorious fitness classes when you sign up at victorious.com/explores. That's victorious.com/explores to try Victorious free for 1 month. It's going to change the way you work out, and we thank Victorious for sponsoring the podcast. We're back. Kristen is a science illustrator by profession, and she's also an artist. She's used her skills at several artist and residency programs at parks over the years, including Joshua Tree National Park and Gates of the Arctic National Park. Hearing Kristen talk about them makes them seem more accessible and the application process less intimidating.
So the first one that I did was actually while I was doing my program in science illustration. I applied to do an artist residency for Gates of the Arctic National Park, and I ended up being awarded it. I think it was in 2011 that I went up there. So I was living in McCarthy at the time, so I was doing art and field sketching here, but it was a really amazing experience to get to go up there and be an artist in residence. There's another woman, Abigail Brown from England, who's a silversmith, and myself. We were the two artists, so we got to do a trip together. And then a park ranger and a volunteer who was also a photographer. And we spent, I think it was 2 weeks, and we got to spend 10 days canoeing down the Noatak River. It was really rewarding to be somewhere different and immersed in a new landscape. It made me appreciate the wilderness up there and also the wilderness and the landscape that's around me here in the Wrangell. So the year after that, I actually applied to get funding through a grant to do kind of my own artist residency in the Wrangell St. Elias, just around my home, which I ended up doing too. And that was kind of an inspiration. But it's really nice to have that balance of going other places and getting to be an artist in residence where you sort of get to see a place and be a voice for that place, especially a place that like a lot of people don't get to. Because, I mean, getting up to the Gates of the Arctic isn't something that's like easy to do. Getting out here isn't something that's easy to do either. But yeah, it was a really amazing opportunity to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's really cool to be able to use your art to share that place with other people.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And that's something all artist residencies are kind of different, but the outreach component or donation back to the park that I did for that one was I created a little field sketchbook, and my hope was that those pages would kind of translate that experience of me sitting there observing the landscape. And obviously it's not the same, but I think that one thing I love about field sketching is you kind of get that sense of being in the place more than you do with like a more polished illustration sometimes.
I asked Kristen what the process is like to apply.
A lot of public lands have some kind of artist residencies, and I've seen more and more coming up, even with state parks in Alaska. And, you know, I'm just focused on Alaska because that's where I am, so it's easier for me to get to places here. But I've seen more and more, and they usually have applications online, and you submit an artist statement and a portfolio of like 10 pieces or so, and usually a proposal of what you're interested in doing there. So there's usually like a pretty standard process. And as an artist, you know, we're always applying to stuff.
Yeah. Does it get easier each time?
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, I think we apply to a lot of things. We get rejected from a lot of things. It's nice when you get awarded opportunities. It's good because it helps me think about what I'm doing with my artwork right then and what I want to do with it. So it is really helpful as far as framing your work. And I think the more you do it, the more you get better at it. But also, you know, your work changes. So sometimes you're like, oh, I want to do this new thing. And then you're like, oh, maybe I should have stepped back and gone back to my older style or, you know, whatever.
So how would you say your work has changed since, you know, graduating from graduate school?
So I've done science illustration, you know, since 2010, I guess, when I graduated, so about 8 years. And recently, I've been focusing more and more on doing my own personal work as well. I love doing illustration, but it's also really nice for me to just have that work that I'm not doing for a client. I'm just doing it because of the stories that interest me on the landscape. And so I've been focusing more on that. When I started doing that, I felt like it looked a lot like science illustration. So there wasn't a very big difference. You know, I could put my science illustrations and my personal work next to each other and it would flow. And I think that's still the case, but I've been working on pushing that more and just trying to bring in different media, like working in cyanotype or with collage or using maps as part of my illustrations or paintings. So just trying new things to figure out ways to tell a story of how we come to understand the landscape and how I see the landscape and come to understand it.
Why do you feel motivated to tell those stories? Why do you want people to look closer at their surroundings?
Really, my goal with all my work, science illustration or my own personal work, is my work is really detailed and I spend a lot of time looking at something. So I'm hoping if someone sees a rock or something that I've taken the time to draw, that they can kind of see the beauty and the mystery and the story in that object, and then it then inspires them to look at their surroundings more closely and to try and find that around them, so that they're inspired to see the beauty around them and maybe ask questions and learn about the landscape around them, and then, you know, be drawn to caring for the landscape themselves and sort of instilling conservation or just learning about the landscape, really. I think if people are drawn to learn about the landscape and ask questions, that motivates them to care about it and take care of it and have more respect for the land.
And how has your kind of relationship with the land evolved living in a place like where you live near McCarthy, Alaska?
The longer I've lived here, the more I've realized that it's our relationship with the landscape is really complicated. There's a lot of different sides of it. And a lot of, like, really complicated histories that I'm not even really sure, you know, how exactly we frame them. But when I was younger, I was probably more, like, or I thought being an environmentalist or someone who cared about the environment was more simple. But when you're living close to the land, I don't know, you just see things, like, it's not always... Well, of course, it's not always the easiest thing to to make the environmental choice all the time. You know, we still like fly in planes and drive places, and I guess when you're living here, you see that more. We don't have trash collection service, so collect all our own trash and take it out, and so you always know exactly how much you're recycling and how much you're throwing away, and you know how much water you're using or electricity, and you know we have solar panels, but still sometimes we run the generator because we don't have enough sunlight, so you know like exactly, not exactly, but you have a better sense of the resources that you're using.
I mean, I don't live off grid, so I take a lot of the energy that I use for granted because it's so easily accessible. So for you living off grid, you can see all of that impact, and you probably feel more conflicted about it because you can see it.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm trying to convey.
After our initial conversation, Kristen emailed me to more fully explain her thoughts about her relationship with the land in Alaska, how she's learning, and how she hopes to continue to learn. We hopped on Skype again to chat about it. It's tough to squeeze everything into one conversation, and frankly, it's easy to feel on the spot in an interview, which can result in not being able to fully explain yourself. Here's Kristen.
Living off the grid and living in a remote place, like you feel very connected to the resources that you use. So I'm always aware of the energy that we get from the sun or the amount of water or how much trash I'm creating. And that can be great because you know what your resources are, but it also kind of weighs on me in some ways because I'm more aware of just how imperfect our relationship to the land is. And I guess one thing particularly about living in Alaska, or one thing that has become something that I've thought about more living in Alaska or just maybe getting older, is that there's a lot of paradoxes in our relationship to the land. So like I live right on the border of this huge national park, the Wrangell St. Elias, and it's free for people to come here and anyone can come and spend time out there, like on the river right outside my window, but it's also really hard for people to come here. So I don't know. And then just national parks are great that everyone can have access to them, but they're also, the land use history with them is complicated. You know, they're basically stolen land, and even though it's great that everyone can go there, anyways, yeah, it's complicated. And so I've appreciated that just longer that I've been here. And I think that those things that are complicated, the paradoxes are kind of like the things that are interesting and worth exploring as well.
The first thought that you brought up around access, like, so yes, the parks are and the land is free to visit, but it's expensive to get there. It's difficult to get there. And it's, you know, the average person listening to this show probably isn't going to see those places. That's part of the kind of paradox for you.
Yeah, exactly. Just the resources that it takes, or even just like the gumption maybe to like go out into this place that, you know, is pretty, like there's a few trails, but mostly there's not a lot of trails. And I think people feel pretty exposed coming out into this landscape too. So I guess there's also like that cultural perspective of just how you grew up and how, if you feel like you can just walk out into this space.
Yeah, and I guess, so for you, do you think about how you can use your art as a bridge for people then?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the reasons why I try, one of the things that like pulls me to try and capture this place or do artist residencies in national parks, because I love creating artwork about places and maybe making those places accessible to people, and that you don't necessarily have to go there to experience a part of them. Also, a lot of the artwork I create is sort of looking at the landscape up close, and sort of trying to have that personal approach versus like these big grand landscapes with mountains that can almost be overwhelming, just kind of giving people glimpses of these little pieces of a place that can feel kind of more intimate or accessible.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. How about the second piece, the fact that like most of these national parks, or all of them, you know, all of the land of the United States was stolen from, you know, Native people.
So it's complicated in Alaska, and Alaska has kind of a unique land history. So there's the Native aspect that this land, I mean, wasn't the United States to begin with belong to the people who lived here, or are the Atna. They still live here and they still have a lot of land here, but they would have used this land to hunt and fish in. There's also a lot of white people who are opposed to the fact that the National Park Service comes in and owns this land and restricts their activities. So it's just, it's interesting from a lot of different perspectives. In some ways, it restricts what people can do here. And there's definitely, that's a whole other story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm sure it's for you as, someone who's relatively new to living there, mm-hmm. to kind of watch that play out as, a semi-outsider, but who also has found a bit of a home in that place.
It's interesting being part of a community, too, because, it's not just, our cabin here. It's our whole community. McCarthy and Kennecott is sort of surrounded by this national park. And there's other communities in national parks. I think because a lot of the parks in Alaska were formed later, a lot of them exist with these communities that have been existing in them, too. So
I appreciate that, sometimes the hard part is just, acknowledging and saying these things and that you know that you don't have all the answers for yourself or have it all figured out, but you're working towards understanding more, and that's going to show itself in your artwork.
Yeah, exactly. And my artwork sometimes starts to touch on some of these things, but they're, somewhere in my mind, and I'm working on exploring them. I think, like I said before, the fact that they are somewhat paradoxical and just really complicated is what makes them interesting and kind of beautiful and meaningful to explore.
To other younger artists who are interested in environmentalism and conservation, would you recommend studying science illustration in school?
Yeah, I wish I'd known more about it when I was younger, and I'm always telling younger people about it. If they like art, it's a really cool way to do art professionally, I think.
Last year and this year I'm going back to teach on the Juneau Ice Field. They do a college semester program down there with the Juneau Ice Field Research Program. And I'm always really excited to share because those students are usually scientists who are interested in studying glaciology. Sometimes other things as well, but last year was really cool to share with them kind of what science illustration is and how they might do it. And, a lot of them might not end up being science illustrators per se or just focus on that, but there are definitely some people who are interested in it and maybe incorporating it into their other work that they do. There's a lot of, different ways you can take it too. Right now, I think you could do a lot with animation or digital illustration, 3D illustration. I'm not even really that good at that stuff. I do a lot of work on the computer with Photoshop, a little bit in Illustrator, but I like drawing with a pen and paper. So that's what I tend to do and even incorporate that into the digital work.
Science illustration is a field that is always growing because there is always more to learn. And the value of an illustration is that it isn't just what meets the eye and tells a story about everything, even what's under the surface, and how they work together.
Photography is really prevalent now. Maybe in some ways because it's so prevalent, having an illustration is even more valuable just because it makes you look at something differently. But there's always going to be things you can't take a picture of, like the inside of a cell or an ecosystem with all the animals in it at once.
That'd be amazing if you could.
Yeah, it would be.
Do you have any advice for other women who might currently be working artists?
Gosh, I don't know. Being a working artist it's hard and it's, I think it's important work too.
I don't have all the answers. I'm still figuring out so much of it myself, but today we see so much of on Instagram and online, all the work that everyone's doing. And it's hard not to feel to judge yourself or feel like you're not doing enough. And I think the more that we can be supportive of each other, and encouraging of each other and just encouraging of ourselves for the work that we are doing, that helps a lot. And then just doing the work, making artwork, putting it out there if you feel comfortable putting it out there, sharing it with people.
What keeps you sharing?
I think what keeps me sharing is just that I love
natural history and the natural world around me, so I love teaching people about that. Not really teaching per se, but just sharing my little slice of, you know, what I see out here. I know that not everyone can get to, like, experience this place or be where I am. I'm really lucky to get to live where I live. I try and do what I can just to share the magic of what I see in the world around me so that people can see, you know, like that flower, that rock that struck me, and sort of sharing this place with people.
Kristen also wants to encourage people who don't necessarily want to be science illustrators to ask questions of the natural world with their art. It's something that you can pursue in addition to your other profession and doesn't have to be especially formal. She stresses that you can keep a sketchbook and share it on Instagram or write a blog, and you would definitely inspire other people that way. Learn more about Kristen by heading to her portfolio site, kristenillustration.com. Kristen also provided some great links to national park residencies that we'll list on the show notes and on the episode landing page. Learn more about the Refuge Outdoor Festival and get your ticket by heading to refugeoutdoorfestival.com. Thanks to both Kristen Link and Siobhan Powell for taking the time to talk with me. Thank you to our sponsors, Otterbox, UBiome, RX Bar, and Victorious. One of the ways you can show your support for this show is by checking out our sponsor links and using our codes. All are listed in the show notes. If you enjoy listening to She Explores, please take the time to review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It'll help other people find us. Even better, share She Explores with a friend. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, so make sure to tag us so we'll see it. And oftentimes, if I see it, I'll share it too. If you enjoy She Explores, you'll probably enjoy our sister podcast, Women on the Road. Hosted by Laura Hughes, it's filled with stories of honest experiences of life on the road from the women who've lived them firsthand. And if you want to meet some listeners of She Explores and Women on the Road in person, we're doing a weekend camping trip at the end of October. Head to the link in our show notes to learn more. Until next week, catch up with us in our She Explores podcast Facebook group. There we talk about recent episodes, give each other advice, and share resources and more stories about our time in the outdoors. It's one of my favorite ways to connect with listeners. Music in this episode is by Jason Shaw, Dr. Turtle, Steve Combs, Lee Rosevere, and Kay Engel, using a Creative Commons Attributions license. Until next week, have fun out there.